Local news, culture, and NPR.
Zin Nick.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, our election 2024 coverage continues. We're keeping you connected this election season. New York's 51st state Senate district is comprised of all or part of nine counties, approximately the same size as Connecticut. It's been represented in Albany by Republican Peter Oberrocker since 2021. This election, Democrat Michelle Frazier is challenging Oberrocker. She lives in Delhi, grew up in Oneonta, where her family operated a greenhouse business for over three decades. Patricio Rubio speaks to Frazier today about how she would address the challenges faced by rural New York in this sprawling district. Plus, a book share at Seeds of Northeastern Pennsylvania, free books for all, drop, swap, or take, and upcoming October events at the Delaware Highlands Conservancy. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Biden will visit Georgia and Florida today to review the damage caused by Hurricane Helene. He stopped in North Carolina yesterday and ordered 1,000 active duty U.S. troops to support state National Guard troops there.
They're going to speed up the delivery of life-saving supplies like food, water, medicines to isolated communities over what the Pentagon calls the last tactical mile.
Biden also visited South Carolina yesterday. Former President Donald Trump will campaign today in Michigan. He will hold a rally near Flint. His running mate, Ohio Senator J.D. Vance, campaigned yesterday in Auburn Hills, Michigan. He's been asked about a question he got during this week's vice presidential debate. Vance did not answer whether he believes Trump lost the 2020 election, and he did not answer the question yesterday.
The media is obsessed with talking about the election of 4 years ago. I'm focused on the election of 33 days from now because I want to throw Kamala Harris out of office and get back to common sense economic policies.
Vice President Harris campaigns today in Wisconsin. Jury deliberations are set to begin today in the federal civil rights trial of three former Memphis police officers. They're accused of killing Tyree Nichols after a 2023 traffic stop. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports video of the brutal beating is key evidence in the case.
Three fire detectives, Justin Smith, Tadarius Bean, and Demetrius Haley, are accused of several felonies, including depriving Tyree Nichols of his civil rights by excessive use of force and conspiring to cover up the attack. Federal prosecutors urge jurors to trust their eyes and ears and give weight to body cam and surveillance video that showed five officers delivering a, quote, beatdown. Two of the ex-officers pleaded guilty and testified against the others. Defense lawyers argue this was a high-risk traffic stop, and officers acted reasonably after Nichols ran a red light and failed to stop when pursued by police. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Memphis.
Stocks open mixed this morning on Wall Street as investors keep a close eye on the job market. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped about 160 points in early trading.
The number of new people applying for unemployment benefits inched up last week, but remains low by historical standards. In recent months, employers haven't been hiring as many people, but they're generally reluctant to let go of those already on the payroll. The strength of the job market will help to determine how quickly the Federal Reserve cuts interest rates. Retailers are beginning to staff up for the holiday shopping season. Amazon says it expects to hire 250,000 seasonal workers, about the same as last year. Target says its holiday hiring will also be similar to 2023. Levi's investors are feeling blue after the company warns sales will be at the low end of its forecast. The jeans maker says it's reviewing options for its underperforming Dockers brand. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR. This is the third day of a strike by tens of thousands of unionized dock workers at more than a dozen ports on the East and Gulf coasts. There are concerns about imports, especially of highly perishable food. But the Energy Department says the strike won't affect U.S. imports or exports of crude oil, natural gas, and other liquid fuel goods. The agency says fuel supplies and prices won't immediately be affected. A science instrument on the Voyager 2 spacecraft has been turned off. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports mission managers shut it down in order to conserve power on the aging spacecraft.
Voyager 2 is over 12 billion miles away. It launched back in 1977, along with its twin, Voyager 1. The two NASA probes are still talking to Earth and exploring interstellar space. They're both powered by plutonium, and as it decays, the electrical supply is shrinking. That's why controllers told Voyager 2 to shut off its plasma science instrument. The command took 19 hours to reach the spacecraft, and its reply took another 19 hours to come back. Four other science instruments are still on, but the power will keep declining, so their days are numbered. According to NASA, Voyager 2 should be able to keep going with at least one working science instrument into the 2030s. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Officials in Taiwan say a typhoon has made landfall on the southern part of the island. At least two people have been killed. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Our election 2024 coverage continues. New York's State Senate District 51 is a convoluted district covering all or part of nine counties in central New York and the Hudson Valley. It overlaps with nine New York State Assembly districts and three U.S. congressional districts. It's about the same size as Connecticut. It's been represented in Albany by Republican Peter Oberrocker since 2021. Michelle Frazier is the Democratic candidate challenging Oberrocker in this election. She hails from Oneonta, where she was raised in her family's flower and greenhouse business. She's a former Oneonta City Council member. She now resides in Delhi, balancing multiple roles as Associate Professor of Criminal Justice at SUNY Delhi, real estate agent, and the mother of three sons. Radio Catskills' Patricio Rabayo spoke to Michelle Frazier as we keep you connected this election season.
I did grow up in Oneonta, as you mentioned. I grew up in a large family business, agricultural business. And then I did take some time. I left the area to go to college, and I purposefully came back with my children, my first son, actually. So we moved back to the area because I really do love it here. This community, these communities are amazing. They're beautiful. I've traveled all over the world, and upstate New York and rural New York is one of the prettiest places you can live. The other thing for me is that we have all of the things that make us able to thrive, right? We have great people. We have water. We have land. We have smart farmers. I'm also a foodie. So being in rural New York, my family fights about which corn is the best and can you eat it 3 hours later than it's been picked. So grew up there. I live in Delhi now, as you mentioned. I'm a professor teaching at an access institution, which is an institution that really works to give people a step to the next level of their lives. And I've loved being a part of that. But as part of that, it felt like I've been throwing one starfish in the ocean at a time. So the story of the boy at the ocean with all the starfish washed up on shore. And the grandfather says, you know, what are you going to do? This means nothing. There's all these starfish. And the little boy says, well, it means everything in the world to this starfish, throws it back in. I feel like I've been doing that for a while. And now I want to clean the beach a little bit. And so that's partially going to Albany to make bigger policy changes.
So I mentioned that, you know, you have a background in public service as the former Oneonta City Council member. You know, what experiences from your time on the council have shaped or were going to shape your approach to state level politics?
Yeah. So I think when you serve on local committees and local boards, local government, you realize that we really want the same things, right? We want quality of life. We want our children to live happy, healthy lives. We want our schools to be good. We want our environment to continue to provide for us and us to provide safety to our families and our communities. So sometimes it's reminding ourselves that we're actually all on the same team. And I really felt like you could do that at Oneonta City Council. The people I worked with really did want what was best. And sometimes that didn't mean we wanted the same thing, but bringing that attitude to Albany, I think, is essential. Because when we have this notion that somebody across the aisle is out to get us, it isn't necessarily helpful for us to actually get to the things that we actually all want. We just have to figure out how to get there sometimes. So I think that was important from my knowledge there. The other thing is it taught me a lot about zoning. It taught me a lot about the IDA. It taught me a lot about a lot of the issues that are actually heading up to Albany and back into communities, right? So there's a dialogue and conversation between local government and state government. So that conversation and that dialogue is something that I've been a part of. And I think it's key to understanding how do local communities function in their government, and then how does the state then partner with that? So I think that's also really important that I learned from my experience on city council.
We have a lot of issues facing the 51st district in New York State here. What would you say are the most pressing issues facing your district?
Yeah, so for me, some of the top three issues, housing is number one for me. I sell real estate, as I've mentioned. And there isn't a conversation that doesn't come back to housing, right? If we want economic development, we have to have workforce housing. If we want communities to stay here and flourish, we have to have housing for those people. We just need to work on our housing. And there's two things that I think are important here. One is we are going to have to build, and we need to build sustainably and in a way that continues to keep our life beautiful here. The second thing is we need as a state to help our local communities. We don't need to stomp on home rule. We need to actually provide data to our local municipalities to help them with their zoning laws, help them put into place the structures that will not prevent them from growth, but also help them know what these zoning laws are going to do to their communities, right? What are the positives of this type of zoning and what are the negatives of this type of zoning? To do that kind of research, you need big money. And that has to come from the state level. Little towns, hamlets, villages, they can't afford those types of big data driven analyses. And so the state has to be helping with that. So I'd like to see the big data done and then a czar put into place that really works with our communities to help them increase our housing stock in a way that's effective for the communities. So that's one. Number two, is the issue of 911, increasing the 911 services to include domestic violence, substance abuse, and mental health specialists. When we look at our system, we want cops to keep us safe. We also need comprehensive services for our people in crisis and communities. Our communities are struggling with substance abuse. They're struggling to provide mental health. And we have placed that burden largely on our cops and our law enforcement. And we need to help our law enforcement and relieve them by providing additional services through 911. And I think that we can do that in an effective way in New York State without even actually having to increase our budgets. We have to just be creative in the way that we use the services that we actually already have. So we connect our opportunity organizations, we connect our substance abuse organizations into the 911 so that we can actually provide better services and keep us safer in our communities. And that is one of the issues for substance abuse as we think about it. Then my third issue, which I think is extremely important, and this is part of the stage of life I'm in and realizing what it takes to thrive in New York, and that is family care. We need to take care of our population in New York from day one to their older years. So for me, I have children, two of whom are neurodivergent, and in the process, meaning autism, ADHD stuff. In the process of that, about a year and a half, 2 years ago, my son was failing. We were getting 13 phone calls a week from the school district. He was really, really struggling. And then when we got services, it took us about 2 years to get those services. When we got those services, my son went from failing to a 93 average, a four-sport athlete, and playing in the marching band. And I want that for every rural child. And we can do that by supporting our school systems, by making the system itself easier to navigate for parents. I say all the time, we adopted our first son, and he's the one who has more significant challenges. I do not have neurodivergence, but many times it's biological. So we've made a system that's so entangled for people who it's difficult to navigate step-by-step-by-step processes. So we need to actually make those processes better. That's by supporting our education, that's supporting our communities, our disability services, childcare, right? We can't have working parents without kids being taken care of. So that's the beginning part. But the end part for me is that the other end of that for me is my mom is 80 years old and my mother is still building snowmen. And she loves it. In fact, every year she sends us her picture of her snowman in her backyard. And sometimes she grabs the neighbor kids. But we know that that's not always going to happen, right? Like there's going to come a time when the snowmen aren't being built. And so I want to make sure that our seniors are able to age with dignity in their homes with home health care. Transportation in rural communities is extremely difficult. And it's even exacerbated further when you are a senior who can no longer drive and have medical appointments. I met with a potential constituent down in the Deposit area, and he needs his medical care in Binghamton. One day a week, they have a bus that takes people to Binghamton. It takes him 2.5 hours on the bus, and he can only make a doctor's appointment on Tuesdays as a result. And the reality is our medical system is not that flexible with getting those things. We live in medical deserts to begin with. So we need to aid our aging population with transportation systems, with medical care, and an increase in our facilities and services for our aging population. And the reason I'd say this is that for me, it's family care. I want to be also very clear is that the point of it is we actually all do better when we have intergenerational living. Right. So my children, I asked them, who's got your back this year? And they said me, which was great. but they also said my mom. Right. And so my children are thriving because my mom's thriving, and my mom's thriving because of my children. And I think that families, we need to support that. And that looks like lots of different kinds of families. Mine looks like a fairly sort of, you know, average family, I guess. But there's all kinds of these family structures that we need to be supporting. So those are the things that I'm seeing as some of the top issues for our communities.
Like you mentioned, one of the issues that we are facing here is housing affordability as a major concern for many parts of New York, especially after the pandemic. How would you mentioned a little bit there, but how would you address the housing crisis in your district?
Yeah. So again, I think a lot of communities are trying to solve this. And one of the problems is that we can't step on home rule, right? Which is the notion that communities actually know a lot about what they need. So we need to aid them in making those decisions. So that's the housing czar. I also think we need to increase our incentives for people to build, right? And build sustainably. A lot of the projects where the money comes from the state are for huge projects, right? They're for units that are, you know, 100 units. Well, the reality is in rural New York, we don't need a 100-unit building. We might need a 12-unit building. We might need a building community that's a set of townhouses. We don't need the same maximizing number. And with economies of scale, yes, it's cheaper to build a massive building. So we need to actually bring the focus to rural New York, which a lot of communities have not been able to do, or a lot of our representatives have not been able to do. So we need to bring the that analysis and that attention to our communities and say, hey, we've got to subsidize how we help these houses get built. We've got to encourage people to build. And that doesn't necessarily fit a lot of the current structures of how we build. The state says, look, you build 65 units. Well, you know, I live in Delhi, 65 units is not going to be what we put in. It's just not going to be feasible. But we need 12 units. We need 15 units. So we've got to be able to help our communities make that happen as well. So that's how I would like to see some of the state moving in that direction.
Now, let's move on to some bail reform topic here. Bail reform has been really a contentious topic in New York State, something often your opponent talks about. What is your stance on the current laws, and do you believe any changes are needed?
Yeah, so I'm aware that bail reform is extremely, extremely contentious. I think there's two things that I think are important. So point one is we have to understand why this happened, why bail reform happened in the first place. Because I think when we get into these arguments, we lose sight of what was the catalyst for this. And that's, we had a young 16-year-old kid in New York City who was accused of stealing a backpack and ended up in jail for 2 years. And it turned out he didn't steal the backpack. And he, due to the trauma from being incarcerated, killed himself, right? So that's the impetus for bail reform. It's not because we love criminals or because we want people to come out and commit more crimes. That is, we're soft on crime. This is the impetus. A study actually came out yesterday from the Brennan Center on Justice that there has been no increase in crime related to bail reform. So it is true that bail reform happened in 2020 at the same time that we saw an uptick in crime in the United States. But what we have to remember is that those, even though they happen at the same time, it doesn't mean that one caused the other. So I like to use the example, for instance, people buy a lot more bathing suits in April. And they also pay taxes in April. So it must mean that the more taxes you pay, the more bathing suits you buy. Well, is that true? No. It's true, actually, that people are paying their taxes because they're due in April, and people buy bathing suits in April because it's spring break, right? The two are not actually related. So the Brennan Center just came out with a study that is confirming other studies that crime is not upticking as a result of bail reform. That doesn't mean that people don't feel less safe. It also doesn't mean that our cops aren't feeling frustrated by the system. So I met with someone just the other day talking about bail reform. And I think really where we need to be working on bail reform issues is working with police officers, our law enforcement, to hear their concerns about frustrations and how we can tweak the system to make their work less frustrating, right? And that's as an overall picture. Cops have had a tough, they've had a tough couple of years. And so this is part of my solution with expansion of 911, right? We're asking cops to do too much and the frustration levels are high. And so I want to actually expand 911 to include these services in part to relieve some of that frustration of our law enforcement. So I think that there's evidence, and I'm an evidence-based person. I think there's evidence that bail reform is not causing crime. And there is some need to ensure that our 16-year-old kids aren't put in jail for extended periods of time simply because they're poor. And so I think this is part of, for me, the balance of thinking about how we proceed with bail reform.
Yeah. You know, given your background in criminal justice, you're a professor in it. You have a doctorate in it. You know, what is you sort of, you went into it a little bit there, but what is your stance on how to improve public safety and justice in our, in your district?
Yeah. So, there's lots of, this is usually if we prevent crime, we become more safe, right? We become safer when we invest early on. So, even the report that came from the Brennan Center, but these are known in the criminal justice world, right? Having services for communities, right? Having jobs for communities, having economic development, having employment and programming for teenagers. So when I'm teaching my classes, one of the things we know is that the most likely perpetrator are teenagers. And crime goes up in the summer. Because what's happened to teenagers in the summer? They don't have places to go or things to do. They don't have constructive things to take up their time. And so that is something that we can do to prevent crime in the first place, right? So this is employment opportunities for young individuals, sports programs, community events, providing safe spaces for our kids, our community members, And as well as things like, and this sounds rudimentary, but lighting, right? Having street lights, having lighting in community makes people feel safer because it is safer. So we need to invest in our early programming so that we can actually make sure that our individuals don't make it to the criminal justice system in the first place. I also, one of my big issues, I teach a class on trauma and crisis intervention. I was a crisis intervention worker in Chicago for 6 years while I was doing my undergraduate. And we know that when we treat childhood trauma, we decrease our healthcare costs. We decrease their use of substance abuse. And I want to make sure that we're funding our school systems so that we can provide crisis and trauma intervention at an early age and catch them before they hit the criminal justice system. So those are some of the things that I would like to see implemented in every school in rural communities and actually across the state is trauma intervention and trauma-informed care in our schools. And we've got to fund that in order to make that happen. But it actually is cheaper on the back end, right? So like if we fund these programs early on, we save money later. So childhood trauma, the data suggests that there's $74 billion a year in care costs due to childhood trauma. So if we can cut that at, you know, at the beginning, we actually be fiscally responsible in doing that.
Let's move a little over to change topics here for economic growth here. What are your steps to promote economic growth and job creation in rural districts? It's such a different, you know, you have agricultural tourism, you have ecotourism, all coming here into Sullivan Catskills. It's a very touristy area, especially during the summer, obviously. So what are your ideas on sort of promote more economic growth and more job creation in our area?
So I think there's a couple places to start here, right? I actually grew up in a business family. These are the conversations we had at the dinner table, right? And I still have a brother who runs a large company here, having conversations with them. And one of the things that all comes back for me a lot of times to housing, they're having trouble getting workers in our communities because we don't have workforce housing, right? There's companies that actually are expanding and they can't get the workers that they need because their workers can't find housing. I have met with one of the larger companies in this district and they said, we always bet on New Yorkers. They actually considered putting their facility in another location, but they found that New Yorkers, rural New Yorkers know how to work. We know how to get things done and we're committed to our communities. And they said, we don't want to go somewhere else, right? But we're also struggling to house our employees, right? So I actually think one of our economic development processes has to be housing. We also have to have the infrastructure of internet. We have places here where Catskill's a little different. But you know, I can barely make it to around the district and make a phone call. You know, I'm driving. I've put almost 8,000 miles on my car, in the last couple of months. I'm everywhere. And I can't make phone calls while I'm there. And that is an economic development issue. And it's also a safety issue, right? If we are unable to make calls to our emergency services due to lack of internet. So I think that's number two, right, is getting the infrastructure for that. Then I think we support our businesses, right? We support our businesses by helping them navigate systems and grants when there are grant opportunities for our businesses. We work to figure out what needs they have and then how do we support those needs. And when I'm out on the campaign trail, what I'm hearing from businesses is they need housing. So sometimes economic development links into other areas. And this is an area that I think is really important to link into. So, yeah.
Now, as a mother of a neurodivergent children, we talked about a little bit about how would you advocate for improved resources. Can you just draw back a little bit more on that and how would you advocate for improved services, and support for families with special needs?
Yes. So first, I would like to say that I think it's incredibly important that we have people who are willing to speak about these things and be at the table. because I know parenting two children with neurodivergent conditions, with neurodivergence, it is extremely difficult. It is time consuming and stressful and all of those things. We need to make these systems more streamlined. So for this is an area that I actually diverge quite heavily with on Hochul. She wants to privatize the process of essentially processing the paperwork. And I think that is a terrible idea. When we start privatizing these kinds of systems, people are trying to make money off the system as opposed to provide the services. And so for me, it's extremely important that we continue to have local providers helping our communities. Because the reality is sending something to Albany and it getting lost in the paperwork is not helpful to a family who's struggling with the needs of their child. So we want to streamline the process. And this also means we need to provide more healthcare providers. It often takes a family 6 months to a year to even get the testing that's necessary for their kids. There are timelines. And then, so that's sort of outside of the school system, because I think there's a need to look at that structure of how we receive services. The structure of the system is extremely layered. It's extremely difficult to navigate. And we cannot continue to place barriers in front of these families. These families already have barriers to getting things done for their kids. So that's one piece. The second piece is the public education, right? So public schools must provide services to children. And parent after parent after parent that I talk to of children generally, but also particularly those who have children with needs, is that it's very difficult for the school district to provide for their students. And it takes a long time to get the services they need. I firmly believe that that is not because schools don't want to provide them. I think it's because they financially have a burden that's difficult for them to provide them. And so they make sure that you really, really need the services because the money is going to impact. We at the state level cannot allow money to continue to impact these small school districts from not providing for their community, right? For not providing for their students. And again, I do not blame teachers. I think teachers are doing the best they can. And I think these school districts are doing the best they can. There are realities. They simply don't have the income in many cases, and they're already starving. The education system. I want to be a part. They're going to be relooking at the formula for education expenditures from the state. And I want to be a part of that conversation because I think rural New York, it takes more to educate in some respects, right? We've got busing that isn't included. In some of more urban areas, they have less need for busing. So we have got to start taking these things into account and students with special needs. And we're understanding special needs better now. So we actually, it's not that, you know, we have necessarily more children who are neurodivergent. We just are understanding it better. And as that becomes the case, we need to continue to fund our schools so that they feel like they can provide these services for these kids and really empower our school districts to help the kids, which is ultimately what they want to do. So that's what I would do. So for me, it's a two-pronged approach. First, we need to make the system itself for disability services. And then we also need to look at the school systems.
So finally, Michelle, when folks go to the voting booth on November 5th, why should folks vote for you over your opponent?
Yeah, so I think there's two main reasons, to be honest. Oberacker, he sits on the opioid substance abuse committee and he misses meetings. In a district where we have one of the highest populations of fatalities due to substance abuse, he is simply not doing his job. And I'm a person who knows how to go to work and do it hard, right? So I have two jobs. I, you know, have three children. I know how to get things done. And he simply isn't doing them. The other thing is when we look at these conversations, rural New Yorkers have been left out of the conversation. rural New Yorkers have not had a seat at the table. And I just saw a quote the other day is that if you are not at the table, you're on the menu. And the reality is we've been on the menu. And we can't have somebody who's in Albany saying, I can't get my job done because I've got bad colleagues and failing to show up at meetings. I am not going to say that I can't get my job done. I am not going to miss meetings. I am not going to let rural New York be on the menu.
We were talking to Michelle Frazier, candidate for the 51st Senate District for the New York State Senate. Thank you so much for joining me on the program, letting me know your thoughts on the issues for this new upcoming election. Again, thank you so much for doing this. Do really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
And our election coverage continues tonight on the local edition. We'll speak with incumbent Republican Peter Oberrocker, who is the current seat holder of the New York State Senate District 51. That's tonight at 6 on Radio Catskill. And a programming note, next week, October 10th, we'll bring you the debate for New York's 19th congressional district between Mark Molinaro, the incumbent Republican, and challenger Democrat Josh Riley. That is next week on Radio Catskill. We'll take a break, and when we come back, the October events at the Delaware Highlands Conservancy, including a bird walk and a bat walk. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Furniture Restore, located on Main Street in Jeffersonville, specializing in antique and vintage furniture, rugs, art, and lighting. Because buying well-made and pre-owned is a better choice for the planet. Online at therestorejville.com. And from The River Reporter, the community newspaper serving four counties along the Delaware River in Pennsylvania and New York. RiverReporter.com. And from listeners like you.
Hi, this is Marco Werman, host of The World. Weekdays at 3, our newsroom connects you with events around the globe. Our reporters in the Americas, Africa, Europe, and Asia get to the heart of the day's news. We bring you international perspectives on issues worldwide and here in the U.S. It's 1 hour each day that broadens horizons and takes you beyond our borders. Join me on The World, afternoons at 3, on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Delaware Highlands Conservancy conserves natural heritage and quality of life in partnership with landowners and the communities of the Upper Delaware River region. Rachel Morrow is the education and volunteer coordinator for Delaware Highlands Conservancy, and she's joining us this morning to talk about some of the upcoming October events from the Conservancy, including, Rachel, a bird walk and a bat walk.
Yeah.
So let's start with the bird walk and a tree walk too. Lots of walks. Friday from 8 to 10. Tomorrow there's a bird walk. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so for those who love birds and like getting up early, we have a bird walk tomorrow. It's just a 2-hour time slot that we will be walking around our 144-acre reserve, which is full of meadows, and be looking for the birds that we might find singing early in the morning. So just a simple walk, but hopefully we'll be able to see lots of fall birds.
Yeah, and you're advising folks to be prepared to walk on slope terrain. Anything else that you want folks to know that might be interested in joining the bird walk early tomorrow morning?
If you have binoculars, please bring those along. We have a couple spares, but it's always nice to have your own set of binoculars, and it'll help you see the birds a little bit better.
All right, and if you're not wanting to get up really early to listen to and look at some birds, Wednesday next week there's a conservation conversation happening. What's the topic of the conversation at that event?
So our conservation conversations program is through Zoom, and it's with our land protection coordinators, Trey and Kaylin, and they will be talking about easements and how you can, as a landowner, conserve your land and do that through the easement process of the Conservancy.
So really, like what you guys do, as we mentioned in the introduction, conserving the nature in the Upper Delaware River and how folks can, you know, partner with you to do that.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. And then moving on, next Thursday, the 10th, another walk, this one with folks who love trees.
Yeah, and this one's a little bit later in the day, so you don't have to get up so early.
Thank goodness.
So, yeah, The tree walk, it's kind of a two-part thing. First, we will have a discussion on different ways you can identify trees, whether it's through leaf shape or the arrangement of the branches or the bark. And then after we have that discussion, we will go out onto the reserve and we will see how you can apply what you learned in that half hour to 45 minute discussion and kind of get more hands-on skills so you don't have to know the exact tree to be able to categorize it.
This again is happening outdoors, advising folks to wear, the appropriate footwear and clothing, prepare for the weather. That's Thursday, October 10th from 1 to 3. Now, I didn't want it to feel like I was rushing to get to this one, but Thursday, October 24th is the one I'm really want to hear more about. Bat-tacular, a bat-tacular program with optional bat walk. Tell us about this bat walk and the bat-tacular program.
So just like the tree walk, it is a two-part program. The bat walk is optional because it will be heading more into dusk and nightfall. So I know some people don't like to be out during the nighttime hours. So it's totally up to you if you want to do the walk. But if you sign up for the program initially, it's going to be a bit of a lecture where you're going to learn about the habits of bats, the different types of bats we have in the area and things that are impacting them. Some people may have heard of white nose syndrome that is kind of killing off our bat species, and we will get more in depth on that. And then afterwards, I have what's called an echolocation reader that you clip into an iPad. And it will actually give feedback sounds of the bats echolocating and give you a rough guess on which bats are flying above you. So that's what we will do as we're walking on the reserve, kind of listening and paying attention to that iPad to see what we're looking around for.
I mean, appropriate for the season, October bats, right? But I mean, I don't know if you agree with me, Rachel, but I feel like bats are one of the most misunderstood animals.
Oh, yeah, for sure. People often see them kind of as these flying nuisances, but they really do us a lot of good. They eat upwards of 80% of their body mass in insects. So if you have a mosquito problem, you definitely want bats around because that's what they're going to be eating.
They're also pollinators, maybe not pollinating mm-hmm. some of the plants in our area, but one of the things that caught my eye when I was just looking into more about bats is that they're the only pollinators of the agave plant, which is a key ingredient in tequila. So cheers to you, bats, on behalf of me. Thank you. Also, they disperse seeds?
Yeah. So not the bats in our area,
right.
But fruit bats. They will eat a fruit and then that'll pass through their digestive system, and wherever they let go, that's where that seed will hopefully take place and plant and grow.
And now when you go for the optional bat walk after the conversation, you use something called a bat frequency reader to find the bats. What does that do? What is that?
Yes, yeah, so it's a sound piece that clips into an iPad, and it will pick up the echolocation frequencies that the bats send out. So whenever bats are hunting for insects or moths or whatever, they will send out a high-pitched frequency that will bounce off of an object and come back to them, and that's how they kind of know where their food is in the air. And that piece that plugs into the iPad actually catches that bounce back frequency as they're flying around you.
Oh, that's cool. Where can folks get more information about all of this, all of these great programs coming up in October?
Yeah, so you just go on to our website at DelawareHighlands.org /events, or just go to our homepage and look for the events drop-down menu.
All right. That's Rachel Morrow. She is the education and volunteer coordinator for the Delaware Highlands Conservancy, telling us about all the great walks and events coming up this October. Rachel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, the free book share is back at Seeds of Northeastern Pennsylvania. We'll learn more about it right after this. This is Radio Chatskill.
The Narrowsburg Chamber of Commerce presents Logging Days, 11 to 5, Saturday, October 5th, Fireman's Field, Narrowsburg, featuring the New York State Lumberjack Association's Lumberjack Contest, Beard and Mustache Contest, Axe Throwing, Line Dancing Lessons, Baking Contest, Kids Activities, Beer Garden, Food, and more. Logging Days, 11 to 5, Saturday, October 5th in Narrowsburg. More information at welcometonarrowsburg.com. Paid for by the Narrowsburg Chamber of Commerce.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl. And the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. Having a little difficulty getting our guest from Seeds on. Let's move on to a conversation we had with Ruby Rayner from the River Reporter last night. Jason Dole spoke to her about a couple of events, a couple of topics, healthcare and a bear.
Yeah, I asked both candidates to address healthcare concerns of Sullivan County residents that came directly out of the recent September 5th town hall style meeting that we spoke about last week, where residents were speaking with leadership from Garnet Health, who operates the only hospital in Sullivan County. And that meeting was organized by Aileen Gunther, the current and retiring New York 100 assembly member. And voters will decide on November 5th if either Democratic candidate Paula Kay or Republican candidate Ingracia will take her seat. And one attendee at the meeting actually did say, election time is coming and we need to think about where to place our vote to get these healthcare issues spoken about and cared for.
And with that in mind, you went to the candidates. What did Ingracia and Kay each have to say about healthcare in Sullivan County?
Top line, both Kay and Ingracia made it very clear that healthcare in general and the healthcare concerns within Sullivan County was paramount and a top priority. Those are both words that the candidates used. Ingracia said that without equalizing health insurance reimbursement rates, nothing will change in the healthcare services and providers available in Sullivan County. He said you have to, quote, follow the money, end quote. He also explained how he doesn't know exactly what needs to be done or what it would look like to equalize health insurance reimbursement rates, but he said that, quote, it's a priority to find out. He also mentioned that he understands both sides, that there's a business end, that services can't be provided where there isn't reimbursement, and also used the word triage center to describe Sullivan County in terms of its healthcare. Paula Kay said that addressing issues around healthcare really is rooted in the people. I'll read a quote from her. She says, quote, it's not just about healthcare. It's about education, childcare, housing, and working collaboratively across the aisle to make sure that we all support each other. She discussed a lot about how she thinks the problem is the hospital isn't able to appropriately recruit. And so there's overworked staffers, and it's a more of a snowball issue. And she says that in order to fill these vacancies of staffers, that it's really necessary to be able to provide attainable housing, which is something that she has discussed before and is a very high priority on her list. And that it's about working collaboratively with large employers in Sullivan County, which includes Garnet Health. And she also mentioned how all of these larger things like housing are very important for attracting young professionals, like the people that are trying to fill these positions at the hospital when they're considering if they're going to move or not.
Yeah, which is an interesting corollary to some of the things that you're hearing from just the general public at that town hall style healthcare meeting, you know, expressing concerns, just like, you know, what resources are available to folks that live here. Here, the availability of those resources plays into the ability to get more resources, to have professionals working in that capacity. So Kay seems to be taking this bigger picture approach and keeping in mind some of these other variables that are affecting the ability to serve healthcare in the area. Discussing housing and staffing issues are linked to it. And Gracia seemed to really be specifically highlighting that low reimbursement rate. Seems like more and more people are increasingly coming back to this reimbursement rate. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, definitely. Both of these kind of issues that they brought up in their approaches were brought up by residents. So, you know, residents spoke about thinking about being a young family and what services are there, similar to what Kay was pointing out. And also people spoke about feeling like there was this push towards providing care outside of the county and that the rationale for that could be because of healthcare insurance reimbursement rates, as Ingracia pointed out in his approach. So a little bit more just to understand healthcare reimbursement rates is that all hospitals and you know, Garnet Health clinical staff are obligated to provide treatment regardless of insurance. And depending on rates of reimbursement from both private insurance and also Medicaid and Medicare, costs then fall on facilities to be absorbed. And in Sullivan County, about 5.6% of residents have no health insurance, and 30% of Sullivan County residents are on Medicaid. So multiple people during this town hall, you know, brought up the fact that because a facility might be reimbursed at a higher rate in Orange County than Sullivan County, that care and services are being prioritized there where there's this higher reimbursement rate. And that speaks to a little bit about the dynamic between Garnet Health having two locations, one in Sullivan County and one in Orange County, those two hospital locations. So one resident of Sullivan County at the meeting, Sarah Van Overkirk, said that, like, when her husband was injured, there was no surgeon at the Garnet Health Harris campus, and that, like, her along with 6 to 8 other people had to be taken to Middletown for care where there was those services available, but in Middletown. And, you know, another person gave an example that said, you know, they had to bring somebody to Middletown for an EKG because Sullivan location no longer had a cardiologist.
As you continue to report on this, what I'm interested in seeing, what I'm curious about, is to what extent other rural areas of New York State or even Northeast Pennsylvania are experiencing a similar reimbursement disproportion that's affecting their ability to get the healthcare service providers that they need in other rural areas. How are they looking at this story? But also, are we just noticing this more because of our close proximity to New York City? Because we're so close, are we feeling this more? Because we're talking about Orange County, it's almost like this gravitational pull. And I mean, Orange County is essentially suburbs, or at least exurbs, of the New York City metropolitan area. So I think that's the next step for this story, is to find out, like, how else are rural areas being affected by this? And are they looking at a same issue with this reimbursement rate?
Definitely. And also, why would a county who has historically low health outcomes in general have, you know, be disadvantaged by also having a lower reimbursement rate?
Absolutely. Okay, before we go, real quick, I heard a short story on your headlines that you do on the weekend that I just need to know more about. Some news stories have legs, as we say in the business. Some stories have legs. This one has legs and fur, because I heard a bear was found sleeping at a local hotel.
Yes, Jason. The Wayne Hotel had an attempted check-in from a very unlikely guest, a black bear. This was about a week and a half ago, and the Honesdale Borough Police were called to assist with the removal of a black bear from the Wayne Hotel. Police Chief Richard Southerton said that ordinarily they really don't try to intervene and they attempt to leave wildlife alone. But the bear had ended up underneath the Wayne Hotel and created a situation where the department felt like they needed to get involved and act. people who were commenting on the situation online suggested that they recognized the bear and that it was part of a family that had been sighted in the area. But as far as the police department said that they could tell, the bear was completely on its own. Pennsylvania Game Commission ended up capturing the bear. They safely tranquilized it, and then they brought it to one of the commission's designated release points. And according to the commission, everything, you know, should be A-okay. And just in general, the police chief made a memo to people that when encountering wildlife, they can contact the police department to make them aware of the situation. But generally speaking, people should, you know, attempt to leave wildlife alone.
Good advice. It was good that they were able to get the Game Commission involved there, too. Well, Ruby, thank you so much for joining us and bringing us all the news.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's Jason Dole speaking to Ruby Rayner of the River Reporter. Okay, good news. We got our guest from Seeds of Northeast Pennsylvania on the line. It's Jessica Chera. She is the Seeds Bookshare Coordinator. She's also a board member. Jessica, good morning.
Good morning.
And, you know, when we were trying to get you on the line and then we got you, I put you on hold and then I can listen to you through a queue here. And I hear you working for the Bookshare because this thing starts today at noon.
It absolutely does. Yeah. I mean, we are already about 30 volunteers strong in going forward today. We are at the Wayne County Fairgrounds from now until Sunday. Volunteers will actually be here a little bit longer, kind of helping clean up. But we are here. We're accepting donations starting from noon until 6 today and donations tomorrow and through Saturday morning. It's quite a large event for Seeds and just the community in general.
Yeah. And just so folks know, like you said, you're taking donations. I think this is a great thing for folks to hear because sometimes people have a lot of books they don't know what to do with. And this is the place to take them if they want. Or if you want to get some books, you can take them, right?
Yes, absolutely. So today and Thursday, today is Thursday, Friday.
Right.
So today and Friday is just donations. Saturday and Sunday are when people can come and they could make a donation Saturday morning, or Saturday and Sunday they can come and take as many books as they want. And this event is strictly run on donations. So we start with no books at all whatsoever. And it's just from the generous of the community that we get somewhere in the neighborhood of 20,000 to 40,000 books, depending on the year.
Wow.
Yes.
So if people want to donate, they donate today and tomorrow. That's between 12 and 6 today and 9 and 6 tomorrow. Can they also take or swap today as well?
Nope. The only taking in or swapping is on Saturday starting at 9 and going until 4, or Sunday from 9 to 3.
Got it.
So if you want your books, you need to come during those times.
This is great. And then this is a big event for you guys. And you guys do such a great job of promoting energy efficiency, renewable, sustainable living. You've got your annual meeting coming up October 15th. You know, we had to cut this a little bit short, but anything else you want folks to know about Seeds before we go?
I mean, Seeds is a great organization that I'm not sure a lot of people that aren't necessarily in renewable energy or whatnot know about. And a lot of times when I call to say, hey, I'm calling about the Bookshare for Seeds, they're like, wait, what is Seeds?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's just a great organization that people should check out. We have a website. It's seedsgroup.net that has all of our information about our upcoming annual meeting, information about the Bookshare and anything else that they can want to be a part of with Seeds.
Yeah, and you know, and I'm sure you'll have more information at the Bookshare. It's free as well, right? So this is all free donation, free taking, and there's more information about Seeds Group at seedsgroup.net. Jessica Chera is the Bookshare coordinator and board member, and I know you've got a lot to get to, so we're going to let you get back to it. Okay, Jessica, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you so much.
All right, that's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. As a reminder, our election coverage continues with more election interviews. We heard from Michelle Frazier today. Tonight on the local edition, we'll hear from State Senator Peter Oberrocker, who's the incumbent Republican that Frazier is challenging for New York State Senate District 51st District, that sprawling district throughout central New York and Hudson Valley. That's tonight on the local edition at 6. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated,
presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Hi, this is Jeff, your host on Radio Catskill's Electric Mountain, featuring the very best of global dance music. I play the best of dance music from back in the day to today, and every week I'll feature a guest DJ spinning a continuous set, bringing their unique style. Come dance with us on Electric Mountain each and every Saturday night from 12 to 2, exclusively on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, warmer, increasing amounts of sun, a high 69, cloudy tonight, and areas of fog late, low 48. That fog we might have to deal with in the morning tomorrow, but then partly sunny and 72, and a pleasant weekend on tap. Saturday and Sunday, sunny and nice, highs near 68. It's 11 o'clock.